Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Friday, September 29th, 2017. With me today, John Martellaro. How are you, John?
I'm good. Good morning.
Good morning. And Kelly Gumond, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you?
I'm all right. It's good to have both of you here.
Hi, Kelly.
Hi, John.
See, I feel all warm and fuzzy inside already. Aw, yeah. So, John, I figured that you could enlighten me today.
Because I'll try.
I need some enlightenment.
About what?
About video. And Kelly, I figured you'd want to be in on this too. So here you
Absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely.
Okay. So John, here's the deal. Apple 4K TV. So now we can get 4K video streams for stuff that we get through our Apple TV. You know, people are buying 4K televisions more and more now. And so we're getting these video streams that have been upgraded for 4K. And that sounds exciting, but I have a feeling that's not exactly what's going on, at least all the time. So what's really happening with all these 4K video streams?
Well, for a long time, I think the community have presumed that when 4K TV hardware came along, that it would be in concert with movies that were shot in 4K video. But that isn't always the case. Many movies are shot in different resolutions, 3.4K, 4K, 8K, depending on the choice of hardware that the studio uses to shoot the movie. What you have to do then is take this mastered shot video and then remaster it down to the target resolution that you're marketing the product as. So if you shoot the movie at, say, at 4K, and you know that everybody only has high definition, then you remaster it down, well, not just master it down to 1080p, 1080 high by 21 by 1920 wide. Mm-hmm. So when the 4K hardware started coming on the stream, especially with Roku and Amazon, there was this sense that, okay, now we're going to get 4K movies. But the other side of the coin was that a lot of writers and consumers were annoyed that there wasn't a whole lot of content out there. Well, so I think part of that solution as seen by the studios, because a high dynamic range is all the rage and 4K TVs are affordable, is we need more 4K content. So they take these videos that were shot at 2K and upscale them and send them out as 4K, which means every pixel is now scaled algorithmically up to 4 pixels. And there's a neighboring algorithm where you figure out what's going on with the neighbors. And you use an algorithm to expand the 2 million pixels in a high-definition video to 8 million pixels in a 4K or ultra high definition, I should say, video, which is 2160 by 3840. So this scaling process is something that has been tough in the early years because we didn't have fast enough hardware. And it's always been kind of an issue. And 10 years ago, TVs weren't so good at it. But now we have really good scaling hardware in our TVs. And so when your TV and even your Apple TV has a scaler, so when the TV senses the stream is coming in at 1080p, mm-hmm. it will upscale it to the native resolution of the display, which is ultra high definition.
Okay.
So you whether you have the scaler in your Apple TV or whether you have it in your actual television set itself, and all TVs have pretty good scalers these days. So what they're doing is they're taking 2 million pixels 60 times a second and spreading them out to 4 pixels for every 1 pixel. And doing that 60 times a second, that's a pretty fancy hardware process, but that's in 2017, we've got the hardware to do that. So you're going to get scaled. The question is the studio scaler any better than yours? Well, yeah, it is. But can you tell the difference? And so in my article yesterday, I referred to a great article by Jeffrey Morrison at CNET about how a really good scaler taking high-definition content and up to ultra-high-definition, you won't be able to tell the difference between that and native 4K just because the difference isn't so great between high definition and ultra high definition as it was when we went from standard definition. It was a huge leap from standard. And mm-hmm. the scalers weren't very good. And so when you tried to watch standard definition on a high def TV, it didn't look very good. It was kind of bad. Again, people got a bad reputation. Scalers got a bad reputation. So really the ultimate question is if a studio takes a 2K movie, a movie that was mastered in 2K and upscales it to 4K and pawns it off as 4K, is that being deceptive? And can you tell the difference? And does it really matter? And the answer is yes, their scaler is probably better because they have more expensive hardware. Can you tell the difference? You probably can't. And all of this probably weighs into the little fracas we had about a month ago when we learned that Apple was trying to get the studios to deliver 4K content when the Apple TV 4K was released for the same price. And now we know the rest of the story. It was probably because Apple realized that many of these movies that were being offered to Apple for launch on an iTunes for their Apple TV 4K were simply upscaled from I should say 1080p to ultra high definition.
So, okay. So instead of going back to the original,
if there was one
that was shot at a much higher resolution,
right.
Excuse me, and then scaling that to 4K, the studios, to save time, I'm assuming, and potentially
yes.
money, they took the versions that had been rendered out at 1080p.
Yep.
And ran them through a program that upscales them, that processes them up to 4K size, even though they didn't have the 4K content to begin
with. I'm guessing that a really strong hardware system at a studio could do that in a few minutes for a movie.
Sure.
That's my guess.
So,
because our TV hardware can do it 60 times a second for an hour and a half on a movie, but to remaster it completely and lay it out on a disc or create a streaming profile, probably just a few minutes. So it's probably pretty easy to do.
Still.
If we can't tell the difference, should we care?
That's where I'm going. Should we care? Because what my knee-jerk reaction is that why should I pay for a 1080p video that's being presented to me as 4K?
That's the question. If it's simply upscaled to 1080p content, is that really premium content? And should you be charged more? Apple was probably on the track of saying, well, you upscaled it, so we shouldn't charge our customers more. And that brings up the question in my mind next is whether the studios are ever going to get to the point where they'll have a branding scheme where they'll say, you know, something like shot in true 4K, you know, as a method of saying, well, I can charge you more for this.
Or maybe they'll call it 4K high res.
That's what it'll be. It'll be like that. Cause like when I went, when I purchased Wonder Woman, cause I bought a disc, when I bought it, one of the options was, it wasn't called 4K. It was called 4K Ultra HD.
Well, Kelly, there's some fine differences in the language here. You know, 4K is 4096 by 2160. It's a slightly wider format. It's a format used by exotic studio cameras for shooting mm-hmm. shooting video, and then they remaster that down to 3840 by 2160, which is ultra high definition. But because 3840 is so close to 4000, mm-hmm. which is still a step away from 4096, the industry has carelessly and in a sort of a marketing fashion fallen into the syndrome of calling ultra high definition 4K. And so you'll see different ways of expressing that. If you just call it 4K, it's only, you're wrong. If you call it 4K / UHD, that kind of clarifies it. If you call it just ultra high definition, that works. The ultra high definition alliance would like us to use just simply UHD and dispense with 4K. But 4K is so ingrained in pop culture and in websites and articles, it's hard to get away from. But the common everyday throw around language of a 4K TV is different than the studio's usage of a slightly higher resolution.
Right. And my problem with all of this is less about what's actually showing up on my screen and more about the heart of the matter, which is what Jeff asked, which is if the studio upscaled it and it wasn't something that started life that way, and the studio went back and bolted this on for me, like they do with 3D, for example, what am I being charged for? Am I being charged for high def content, or am I being charged for something 4K or some sort of, you know, flavor of 4K that they're trying to tell me is worth 10 extra dollars when in real life it's not?
The irony is that all your home equipment's going to have a scaler that does a pretty good job. So if you bought the movie in high definition and you display it on your system, mm-hmm. your TV is going to upscale it anyway.
Right.
That's the irony of the situation. So it's really kind of a marketing gimmick.
Aren't they all?
Yes.
So I'm still not feeling great about 4K content from the studios.
I'm not either.
One of the readers of my article yesterday pointed out there is a website called Real or Fake 4K, one word. It has a list of real 4K movies that are mastered in 70 millimeter or 4K, and then movies that were shot at 2.8 or 3.4 and are almost 4K, and then there's what they call fake 4K movies that have been upscaled from 2K to 4K. And they're using that 2 and 4K language, which is common, but probably not technically right.
They even have this nice plain list on this site of, and it goes back to, like, the real 4K goes all the way back to the 1930s, it says. And it shows what's real and fake 4K. So,
well, I think they may be referring to 70 millimeter film, which is...
You can click on each one and find out what it is that puts it on that list.
Yeah.
So there's that. It's got that going for it. But
yeah.
I just thought that was... Like, I have this nice plain list I can just go look at. So thank you, reader, for pointing this out, because this is awesome.
I'll link here's the thing. Link in today's show notes.
Yes, please. Because here's the thing that's very interesting to me. You know what shows up under fake 4K? Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Oh.
I know. So, there you go. But otherwise, this is a great list, and I'm really glad that I have it, and it makes me happy.
Awesome. So, all right. So, I don't think we're going to have this resolved today. We're going to need to see a lot of movies for science.
The bottom line is just use real or fake 4K. Be aware, know what you're buying, and try to avoid paying extra for content that isn't shot in true 4K.
Just like everything, we have to, just like everything, awareness, knowing is half the battle, as they used to say when I was a kid.
Or as they would also say, me, 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 me. There's a subset of you that totally get that joke. And for those of you that don't, go ahead and shoot a message to me or to Kelly, and we'll fill you in. All right. So I want to talk about something else before we have to wrap up. And the something else is actually someone else, and it's Tim Cook, but it's also Apple. And John, you have some really great insight into Apple since you've worked there and you've followed the company for so long. Excuse me. Is Tim Cook the right guy to be leading the company? Do they need someone that is more of a visionary kind of guy? And I'll sit back and break out the popcorn for this one.
Well, I think the subject resurfaced about a week ago when this video from Steve Jobs started percolating around the internet about how he talked about how salespeople are only focused on increasing sales and don't really have a vision for products. And I watched the video and it started percolating around some friends of mine and I who used to work at Apple and some who still do, and pondering whether any of this video from Steve applied to Tim Cook. Mm-hmm. Because there are many different opinions about whether Tim Cook is a product visionary, whether he needs to be. We have to remember that Steve Jobs was a kind of person who brought Apple back to life, but also recognized that you need a different kind of personality to run a company in its maturity. I've written about this before in the context of an aerospace company I worked for, where I saw three different project managers in a project during the time I was on the project. The first guy was a fiery Greek who was full of fire and brimstone and was always on travel and got the money and schmoozed with the government and made sure everything got started and got the building built and, just was a shaker and a mover. Mm-hmm. But he was so abrasive and so high energy that a scientific program couldn't function under him. And so the management of the company wisely brought in a cerebral leader, somebody who had a history of managing high-tech technical projects, handsome as hell, wore horn-rimmed glasses, calm, smooth, understood science and the scientists. And so that was phase two. And then the project really wound down later for other reasons. And then they brought in a guy who was about ready to retire to oversee the winding down of the project. So
it wasn't so much a matter of, oh man, we have to get rid of this guy, he's a problem. It was seeing that this project is in a different phase,
right?
And you need to have a different type of leader.
That's right. Phase. That's right. And so I always think about that when I see Tim Cook managing the reins of a company that's quite a bit different than the company that was being resuscitated, the One More Thing company, the product focused company, the company that, hung its hat on the cube or hung its hat on the 23-inch cinema display as a thing or hung its hat on Mac OS X as Unix. And that was their one shot. That was their only round in the chamber, so to speak. And the company lived or died by those products. Mm-hmm. And it was a glorious time. But now Apple's a very different company, very mature. Lots of different irons in the fire, working on autonomous vehicles, working on AR and VR, maturity in the phones, Macintosh, sound, music. So all the different things that Apple's doing in their repertoire requires a person who can manage the visionaries, who can manage the growth of the company. And that doesn't necessarily require the leader to be a product visionary. It requires him to understand and manage and be in sync with the product manager, the product visionaries that he manages. So I'm going to talk about that today in Particle Debris.
I'm looking forward to reading that. And so what I'm getting out of this is that for Apple, there was a phase where they really needed the visionary to be the focal point. And Steve Jobs was the leader that brought the right type of vision to the company. Once the company reached a certain level where it was beyond just coming up with the next amazing new product.
So the new smell wore off is what you're saying.
The new smell wore off. And then it was a matter of, okay, so how do we take what we've got and grow it into something more? And then at that point, you need someone that can manage visionaries.
Right. That's my thesis.
And is that the phase we're in now?
Yep.
Okay. So do you think Apple has the visionaries that Tim Cook needs?
Well, for a long time, I worried about the Macintosh. From 2014 to 2016, I think internally Apple fixed that problem. My thanks, Mark Gurman, mm-hmm. for lighting a fire under Apple on Christmas of 16. Certainly they have a great product visionary in Jonathan Ive. I think that one of the things that Tim Cook may have learned is that too much focus on style doesn't get product out the door. And he may have learned a lesson in letting Jonathan be too far overboard in style and not letting form follow from function.
Is that your a gentlemanly, polite way of saying that the Power Mac cylinder will never happen again?
That's one way to put it.
So one thing that I thought was interesting about this was a lot of people who, once Tim took over, first of all, there were the wave of people going, well, who's this guy? Because nobody realized he'd worked at Apple with Tim for as many years as he had. And also that Tim primarily comes from a supply chain thing. Like, his jam is making sure that prices are what they should be and not a penny more, and just-in-time manufacturing and all kinds of other stuff that I could talk to you about that's super not interesting if you're not interested.
Orchestration.
Right. So it's a matter of, getting things to reach supply-demand balance, which is a thing they talk about in the quarterly calls all the time, making sure that you're making as many as you need and not more than that. And a lot of that comes by juggling parts and manufacturing and assembly and shipping on a global scale, literally on a global scale, because as we know, this stuff gets made all over the place, and then it all has to end up in one place to get put together, and then it has to get from the place where it all got assembled to my house. For example, I just got an iPhone 8. So these are the kind of things that Tim was always really good at. And I've known people who have been able to tell stories about Tim Cook being part of the supply chain and what that looked like and how things were different under him than they were previously. And finding, so it feels a little like part of why he sort of got to be the next guy in the big chair is because Apple was that company. And I feel like that's almost another thing that we can attribute to Steve's vision is, now that we are this company, now that this is what Apple looks like, this is the kind of leader that we need. And all I can hope is that Tim has the same sort of vision that Steve did, which is to get creative people to do interesting stuff and be able to put an Apple logo on it and make that stuff happen. And I think we kind of swung a little wide for a while, and I think we're kind of coming back to it. So that's a thing that I hope will get borne out. The iPhone 10, I think, is evidence of that. The iMac 5K is something that people I know who have iMac 5Ks are absolutely in love with those. I think the iMac Pro is going to be similar. I know the new iPad Pro is a spectacular device. I have a super crush on it. Mm-hmm. I think we went a little wide with the R2D2, the black R2D2 Mac Pro. And I think we're sort of getting back into where Apple should be, which is that sweet spot between unbelievable like design and exceptional function.
Don't forget, Tim started out as supply chain and then COO, and right. He's been CEO for 6 years now. So I think he's learned a lot. We've seen him mature.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I think he had to come from that sort of boring place of supply chain and doing all of that. And that's exactly maybe not necessarily, it didn't necessarily have to be Tim Cook, but the person who came up that way is the person we needed for sort of Apple, 3.0, I guess, because we had, when Steve left, it was 1. And when he came back, it was 2. So now Tim taking over, I feel like, is 3.0. And, that's exactly who needs to be there. John, like you were talking about with different styles of leaders, that's, you were right. There you go, people. I think that's a thing that is going to be very interesting to see going forward. Also, now that I feel like we've sort of settled into this, we've got a lot of innovation, but we've got a lot of usability and stuff behind that. And so I'm hoping that we can continue to refine and get even more interesting stuff out of Cupertino as a result.
All right. So here's what I'm getting, and we have to wrap up. So I'm gracefully wrapping us up. If Apple were a band, when it was on the rise, we had the lead guitar soloist running things. Once the band became incredibly successful, then you needed to have a band director to orchestrate all of these amazing soloists. And so we're at the point now where we've gone from Steve Jobs trying to be the star and lead the band to we have all these different soloists that can work together because they have the right band director, Tim Cook. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Yes.
Awesome.
Although I am going to have to give you a half point deduction for not having turned that into a Van Halen, Van Hagar scenario. Yeah.
We just didn't have time.
I know. I just really thought that was where you were headed. And then Steve left and we got Van Hagar. So yeah.
and there are pros and cons to both Van Halen and Van Hagar.
We'll have to save that for another show.
See, this is why we couldn't go into it today.
Also, hi, Dave Kalo, because I've now said Van Halen three times and now I know he's listening.
Yeah, he has a special superpower where he doesn't actually have to be listening to a show to know that Van Halen's been mentioned, and then he will go and find the show to hear it.
Yeah. So I'm sure I'll hear from him in about an hour.
Yeah. Hey, Dave. All right. Well, we are out of time, so we have to wrap up. John, thank you for being here today.
You're very welcome. It was fun.
Loads of fun. Kelly, thank you for being here as well.
It was my pleasure. Bye, John.
Bye, Kelly.
Oh, that's just so sweet. Listeners, thank you for being here. I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. We'll see you again on Monday.